Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Greetings, genies everywhere, and welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's family history show, and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, the radio root sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Well, you know, we have a lot of fun here on the show. We learn a lot, and we will today. But we have our serious moments, too. And many of you have sent me some very kind messages concerning my involvement in locating the next of kin of Teresa Greaves, the New Jersey girl who disappeared in Utah in 1983 and whose remains were just found in February. I appreciate the messages, but I also hope to keep some attention on Teresa's family as they are finding the costs of eventually bringing Teresa's remains back to Virginia, where she can be buried with her grandmother who raised her, prohibitive. And as you may have heard in last week's program, Debbie Vevers, Teresa's high school classmate from Collingswood High School, New Jersey, class of 77, has set up a GoFundMe site for people to contribute to assist the family. Should any extra money remain after Teresa's burial, it would be earmarked for a scholarship fund in Teresa's name. If you'd like to contribute, the link to the page can be found through our site at ExtremeGenes.com. And later in the program, now that she's had a little time to process all this, I'll be talking to Teresa's cousin and family spokesperson, Kathy Greaves Spurgeon. She'll tell us a little about Teresa, share some memories, tell us how the family is coping and how things are progressing towards Teresa's remains returning to the family. And by the way, People.com has done quite the write-up on all this, and you can see the article online now. The link is with many other national articles on this story on our site, ExtremeGenes.com. And before we talk to Kathy, coming up in about 8 minutes, we'll talk to well-known blogger Randy Seaver of GeniumMusings.com. He's got a great concept for finding others to help you with your research for nothing. And a great story to go with it, of course, which is just the way we like it around here. Hey, and just a reminder, if you haven't done it yet, take just a few moments and download our free Extreme Genes podcast app. It's the best way to catch up on past shows from the past 2 years. It's available for both Android and iPhone in your phone store. One quick download and you can listen to us when and where you want. And by the way, our Extreme Genes Facebook page is a great way to ask for ideas on finding your ancestors. So come join our growing Extreme Genes community and feel free to ask a lot of questions. It is time once again for your family histoire news for this week from the pages of ExtremeGenes.com. And we start with an amazing story about Spain and how it is reconnecting with its Sephardic Jewish heritage. Back in 1992, King Juan Carlos called the Spanish Inquisition, which took place in the late 15th century, the worst mistake ever made by Spain. And he apologized to Jews everywhere, saying the cost to Spain was the loss of talented, cultured, and hardworking Spaniards. An article in the Jerusalem Post notes that Jewish presence in Spain is now beginning to regenerate, the result of a project called the Network of Spanish Jewish Quarters. Old synagogues are falling back into Jewish hands, being filled with Jewish artifacts, and people on the streets are hearing lectures on Jewish customs. What many Spaniards don't realize is that many of them may be descended from a line of Jewish mothers that's unbroken for 500 years. Late last year, a law was passed granting Spanish nationality to any citizen of any nation that can prove Sephardi heritage. The waiting period was removed, and residence in Spain is not required. The common belief is that the reason for all this interest by the government and the people of Spain in restoring their Sephardi ties and population is because of their struggling economy. Spain is now a strident supporter of Israel. And if you were to visit Spain today, you'd see conferences and tours and even virtual tours of historic Jewish sites. As a result, many Sephardic Jews are now going about the task of researching their lineage to prove their Sephardic background. There's a lot more to this story. Read about it now at ExtremeGenes.com. Well, last week, of course, marked the 150th anniversary of the conclusion of the Civil War. In connection with that, the Washington Post has a remarkable story about the research of Reverend Alfred Jones III of Appomattox, Virginia. Reverend Jones was asked to deliver the eulogy for one-time slave Hannah Reynolds, who was the only civilian to die at the Battle of Appomattox Courthouse, the last major battle of the war. Hannah was a slave in the household of Samuel Coleman. Now, she'd been left to care for the house while the Colemans fled the battle site. The date was April 9, 1865. Sometime during the battle, a cannonball ripped through the home and into Hannah's arm, a wound that ultimately took her life. History has always noted that the only civilian to die in the battle had been the slave, Hannah Reynolds. As Reverend Jones researched Hannah for his eulogy on the anniversary, he learned that Hannah did not die as a slave. In his research, he came across an 1865 death register. The record, maintained on microfilm at Jones Memorial Library in Lynchburg, was filled out by the slave owner, Samuel Coleman. As it turns out, she lived for 3 days after the battle and 3 days after the surrender of Robert E. Lee, April 12th. Her life was possibly extended by the aid of a Union chaplain and surgeon. Hannah died as a free woman, as noted in the death record, where Samuel Coleman himself wrote that his relationship to her was former owner. To quote Reverend Jones, "I thought that was so powerful. It shows the owner was able to recognize the significance of this death. Even in this evil institution, there were relationships that were forged, histories that were intertwined." Reverend Jones continued his research and will be continuing it, but before he delivered Hannah's eulogy last week, he was able to locate descendants of Hannah's stepchildren through her husband Abram — she and Abram didn't have children of their own — as well as descendants of the slave owner Samuel Coleman. Descendants of both families were present at the ceremony, which included artifacts from Samuel's home, and one of them is believed to be a chair that had once belonged to Hannah Reynolds. And that's your Family Histoire News for this week. Read more about these and other stories on our website, extremejeans.com. All right, coming up next, we'll talk with blogger Randy Seaver of GenieAmusings.com, who has a unique idea for how you can get free help on some of your most difficult research problems. Then later, Kathy Greaves Spurgeon, cousin of Teresa Greaves. It's all ahead on Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show. We are back at Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth, with my good friend Randy Seaver. He is a genealogist. He's a family historian. He's a speaker. He is a blogger extraordinaire. You can see his site, GenieAmusings.com. Randy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Fisher. How are you?
Good. It is about time we had you on, because you have so many interesting insights in so many different areas. And you know what? I like having experts like yourself, because you can introduce us to new things that we haven't considered before in our research. And what do you have this week?
I was just going to tell you that one of my lessons learned recently is that I'm not that smart.
That's why we talk to other people.
Right. Exactly right. And I wanted to talk a bit about crowdsourcing.
Crowdsourcing for family history research. I have never done this before. Talk about it.
Well, this is how you find out things that you don't know, by having other people help you. You've heard of crowdfunding, you know, where
sure.
You put something out there that you want funded and people contribute. Well, crowdsourcing is people contribute ideas or information or even sources to you, having, say, put out a genealogy problem.
Now, you noted here, you said, I found out I wasn't that smart. What did you mean by that?
None of us has enough experience or expertise to know everything. And so when you get out of your comfort zone, which mine is kind of New England, that leaves a big world. And the story I have to tell you today is about California, Australia, and England.
All right.
And I'm not comfortable in two of those places. And I got a lot of help, and it was wonderful help. It helps to have a blog, and
right.
It helps to have readers, and my readers help me. So let me tell you the story about discovering Jane's roots.
All right.
And I have a whole presentation for this that, you know, people can ask me to present to them. My wife's great-grandmother is Jane Whittle McNew, born 1847, and all the records say that she's born in Australia. And she died in 1921 in San Francisco. They had 11 children. She's married to Elijah McNew. And the death certificate that my brother-in-law got for her many years ago said that her parents were Joseph Whittle and Rachel Moore, and that they were born in England. And so we probably have a case here of England to Australia to California.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. So I found a lot of U.S. records, and I was stuck back at 1860. It was the earliest record I had in the census, where Jane was age 13. It says born in Australia and living with a couple, William and Elizabeth Ray. And Elizabeth is age 21, born in England. So that may be her sister. I don't know. And they're in Calaveras County, California. And her husband was listed two lines below her. There's also a Joseph Whittle in Calaveras County in the 1870 census, born in Australia, and he's age 27, so he's born like 1843. So I don't know if Joseph and Jane are brother and sister yet, but that's a possibility. So I'd search California records, especially in San Francisco and in Gold Country, for Joseph and Rachel Whittle, the nominal parents from the death certificate. And there were two Joseph Whittles in San Francisco in the 1860 to 1870 time frame. Was one of those her father? I can't tell. And there's no other records I can find. I got a breakthrough in August of 2010 when the 1852 California State Census came online. And it showed Rachel Whittle, age 31, born in England, and children Elizabeth, age 13, Joseph, age 17, born in Australia, and Jane, age 5, born in Australia. And I think that's them. Where's the father?
Sounds like him.
I don't know where the father is. It's Waddle. It's W-A-D-L-E instead of Whittle. W-H-I-T-T-L-E. But it's close enough.
That's another lesson right there, that there is no correct spelling.
Exactly true. There's more lessons coming. So I wrote a blog post about this find, since I had nothing better to write about that day, and asked my readers for suggestions. And immediately a fellow named Rod Van Kooten, down in Australia, suggested using the New South Wales Birth Record Index that was online in Australia. And so I did, and there was Jane, born on the same day that her death certificate said, September 12, 1847. And there were four other Whittle children on the list, including Joseph, born in 1843. So I think I found Jane's birth. The surprise was that the father given name was Alexander Whittle and not Joseph.
Boy, that often happens at the back end of somebody's life, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it does, doesn't it? Another lesson learned. So I wrote about that the next day, and Rod said, well, you know, if you look at the Trove website in Australia of historical Australian newspapers, you might see something. And sure enough, there were articles about Alexander and Rachel and their pub on Sussex Street in Sydney, Australia.
Wow.
Yeah, cool. And Trove is a wonderful resource. Trove is just a wonderful resource for early Australia newspapers, I think up to the present, too. The Australian folks just rave about it. Another article said that Alexander left for California in late 1849 and Rachel left in 1850. So where did they come from? So I posted a question like that, and another reader suggested, well, look at the passenger list records from England to Australia. They just come online at Family Search.
I love it.
And voila, there they were. Alexander and Rachel and their daughter Elizabeth were on the ship called the Brothers and arrived in Australia in 1840 after 6 months at sea. Absolutely unbelievable. And the records gave the place of birth and their parents' names. So Alexander's parents' names were Alexander and Margaret Whittle, and they were living in Bolton Lemoore in Lancashire. And Rachel's parents were given as Robert Morley and Jane Haslam, and they were also in Bolton Lemoore. So Rachel's last name was Morley, and not Moore, as it was in the death certificate. So the death certificate had two things wrong, Alexander's name and Rachel's last name. So I worked my way back and found a number of English records, and then when I went to Salt Lake a month later, I tracked down the marriage record of Alexander and Rachel and the birth record of Elizabeth and Rachel Morley's baptism, record in 1821, with only the mother, Jane, listed. And it turned out that the purported father, Robert Morley, had died in 1815. So Rachel was illegitimate. And the English records gave me several more ancestral families in the Whittle and Haslam lines to go follow. And I did. But what happened to Alexander and Rachel in California? Because they got on the boat.
Right.
And did they show up? If they didn't, how did the three children get there? So after I asked the question on my blog, two readers, and one was in Sweden and the other one was in Ontario, had resources that I didn't have in newspapers. And so they found articles that noted that Alexander Whittle committed suicide in Calaveras County in Gold Country, California, in 1853, and the cause being a drunk and having an absconding wife.
Oh, boy.
So isn't that cool?
Wow, yeah, just to find that information, though, is just outstanding.
Unbelievable, yeah. And one of the newspapers was a New York newspaper.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
A California newspaper, but one was a New York newspaper.
Well, and I would imagine the New York paper picked it up from somebody else, maybe that very paper that you found in California.
Yes, they did. I'm sure they did, yeah. And then I found newspaper articles for Rachel also, one where she married in San Francisco a Thomas Spencer in 1854, and then another one in, like, 1859 where she's accused of being a madam at a ill repute. So those findings were pretty depressing for my wife, but they were pretty interesting to me as a genealogist. Telling my wife and her brother, that didn't go over very well.
Yeah.
I'm just the reporter here.
Right.
It's not my ancestry.
I understand.
So it turns out the three surviving children, Elizabeth, Joseph, and Jane, all married and raised large families and seemed to be successful in life up in Gold Country and in San Francisco, even though they had these hardships in their childhood. This kind of lays to rest the sins of the father are on the children for five generations, because they all succeeded, and their kids have succeeded. And
isn't
my
that
wife,
great?
Obviously, is four generations after. The last part of this, jump ahead to Rootstech this past February, and I met a number of Australia-based bloggers, and I think you probably did too.
Yes.
And one of them is a lady named Sharon White, and she lives near Sydney. I told her the story, and she was just mesmerized by it. And I told her Sussex Street in Sydney, Australia, was where the pub was. And she said, you know, my husband works down near Sussex Street in Sydney, and I'll see what I can find out about the pub, and maybe we can locate where it was. And so this is crowdfinding, you know.
Yes.
And so she went down there, took a lot of photos with her husband. They studied the pub license records and maps, which still exist from the 1840s. And she thinks she knows where the pub was, but the area has been really modernized. It's in the tourist and business area of Sydney downtown. So she's nailed down pretty close to where it was. I need to go back and walk that street. So long story short, crowdsourcing using my genealogy blog works for me because some readers have more expertise and experience than I do, or they have access to more resources than I do. And in this case, the help from my friends cracked this case in less than 3 weeks after 10 or 15 years of searching for answers. People like to help.
Yes, that's right.
And on my blog, I offer a lot to readers. You never know when it's going to strike someone's fancy. People like to help.
It's a great blog. It's geniemusings.com. Now, Randy, if we don't have our own blog, what do we do to get crowdsourcing? What might you suggest?
Well, I would suggest there are message boards that you can, I mean, that was crowdsourcing 20 years ago, was a message board.
Sure.
on RootsWeb, wasn't it?
Yeah, and many of them are still there.
All the RootsWeb are still there, and the genealogy.com boards are still there. You just can't add a new post. Also, there are a lot of groups on Facebook now for different surnames and different places, cities and counties and states and regions and countries. And you can join one of those and ask a question, and perhaps someone can help you.
Well, that's a great suggestion. Great ideas. I love it. That's why we talk to you. Randy Seaver, he is the genealogist, family historian, and speaker, and, of course, the great blogger at geniemusings.com, distant cousin of my boyhood hero, Tom Seaver of the New York Mets, and which is really why I like you for the most part, Randy.
Oh, thank you. If people want more detail on this story, which goes on forever, they can Google Whittle Compendium, and it should be right at the top of the list.
All right, great stuff. Thank you so much, Randy Seaver.
Okay, be listening to you.
And coming up next, we'll talk to Kathy Greaves Spurgeon. She is a first cousin of Teresa Rose Greaves, the murder victim we told you about last week, whose remains were found back in February. We'll find out how the family's doing and what their plans are to bring Teresa back home. That's next on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. You have found us, America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes. I am Fisher, the radio root sleuth, and on the line with me right now is Catherine Greaves Sturgeon. She is a first cousin of Teresa Rose Greaves, who we spoke about last week. Her remains were found in February in Utah, the victim of a murder that dates back to 1983. And through some efforts with many other people, I was able to locate Kathy and her family. And Kathy, how are things going for you all?
It's going. We're hanging in there. We're just taking everything day by day. And, you know, just waiting to see what the authorities have to say. And that's it right now. We're just hanging in there.
Now, your dad was an uncle to Teresa, and he's still with us. How is your dad doing?
Yes. He's doing better than he was when I first told him what was going on. In the first few days, he was in denial, and he took it really hard. And then once he understood that it was really true, then, yeah, I got worried about him. But he pulled out of it, and he's doing better than he was. And I know he's worried about different things that's going to happen. He's just still a little confused on things, but he's getting there.
I mean, it goes back 32 years. Isn't that unbelievable?
Yes, when she disappeared in Utah.
Well, I've got to tell you that when I heard from your sister-in-law and then I heard from you after almost 3 weeks, it was very emotional for me just to make that connection and to be able to tell you what had taken place.
It was a shocker hearing what we heard. And we're glad now that, even though it's been 32 years, her remains have been found. And hopefully we have some real solid answers, and then she could really be laid to rest where she needs to be.
That's right. And that's going to be sometime in the next few months, as I understand it, right?
Yes, possibly, yes. A few weeks, few months. We're not totally sure. They're investigating everything. So it's going to take a while for their investigation to really be thoroughly done.
Now, for people who aren't totally familiar with the story, Teresa was born in New Jersey in 1959.
Yes.
And then sometime after high school, she moved to Utah with a friend, a roommate, because
yes.
she was interested in Donny Osmond.
Yes,
I understand.
And the Mormon culture. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And so uh-huh. she wanted a change in her life, and she moved to Utah and then disappeared on August 5th of 1983, and no one ever saw or heard any trace of her again.
No.
And so
no.
for all this time, your family has been wondering. Her mom has since passed.
Yes.
It was the understanding of the authorities and what I was told initially and everybody that the immediate family was all deceased. So when I began the search, it was to find first cousins or the closest of kin that may be out there. You, of course, had thought that her half-brother was deceased as well. And as it turned out, that wasn't the case.
Right. Yes, my father thought that years ago because of Peter's health conditions. And I guess the last time him and Peter spoke was probably maybe over 20 years ago. And he just thought that Peter wasn't around either. And when you couldn't find anything, death certificates, you know, of course, we had a look. And like I said, you helped find his Facebook page. And then I was able to email him. And then, of course, look through other areas. I'm trying to find where he is to locate him. And we did. So, yes, he is alive. But, yes, his mother did pass away. And my grandmother did pass away, too. So that immediate family that was on the missing person report, they were deceased.
They are all gone. But
yes.
we found the half-brother. We'll just yes. give his first name because he wants to remain anonymous through this.
Yes,
Peter.
Does.
Have you spoken to him recently?
I talked to him a few days ago. He's getting better, but he is really taking this really, really hard. And being he's up there in up North Jersey all by himself, there's no family for him. It's harder on him.
Right. And you're all in Florida right now, your
yes,
whole group.
We're in Florida. I'm going to see what I can do, hopefully in the next few weeks. I have a job coming up that's lasting 10 days that I have to do for a client. And after that, I'm hoping I can get up to Jersey and spend a couple days or so with Peter and give him some support.
You were pretty close in age to Teresa. Could you tell us a little about some of your memories of her?
Yeah, we were 4 years apart. She was 4 years older than me. And we would, on the weekends, I would go over to my grandmother's. And, of course, Teresa lived with my grandmother. So we would always play together as young children. And, you know, we had our little magazines, Tiger Bee and whatever else there was back in the day that I can't remember. But, yeah, we used to trade posters and we listened to different, like the Oak Ridge Boys and Kenny Rogers back then. Of course, then the Donny Osmond and Leif Garrett, we all like, had our favorites and music. So and we would play together and we had fun playing hopscotch. They lived above like a candy store and stuff, so we used to go downstairs and have fun getting candy and little fishies. We had really fun back then until my parents moved us farther away. So then probably when I was like 12 or 13, I didn't really see her as often as we used to.
She was kind of a big sister figure for you then almost,
yes.
right?
She was like the big sister I never had. And when she disappeared, it broke my heart. Because it was like a part of me died.
Yes, and I'm sure a lot of this brings a lot of that pain back, understandably.
Yes, because I'm thinking of things that we used to do and, you know, with her grandmother, you know, going up the steps and annoying her sometimes. And
well, hopefully in time here, the sheriff's department will be able to find out who did this and bring that part of the investigation to a conclusion as well. And, you know, I understand there are a lot of costs involved now in bringing the remains of Teresa back east. You're talking about burying her now with her grandmother, who she lived with, in Virginia.
Yes, she's in Virginia in a cemetery there in Newport News. And that's our goal, to bring her to be with her grandmother, being that my grandmother raised her since she was a baby. and they were really, really extremely close. You would think they were actually mother and daughter. And they were so close. Wherever my grandmother went, Teresa was there. Everybody knew Teresa and my grandmother in that small little town they lived in. And so she needs to be back with my grandmother. And especially since when Teresa did go missing, it was my grandmother that stepped up and did all she could to find her between the missing person report and then the PI. So she needs to be with my grandmother. And that's the goal. Yes, when we are able to get a release and then have her shipped out to us, and then we will bring her to Virginia to have a proper memorial for her.
Now, I understand that her high school class of 77 have been putting together a fundraiser to help with those costs, and so far have raised over $3,000, but the costs have actually exceeded that, which has kind of surprised me. Nonetheless, I know that there's going to be negotiation going on to make this happen.
Yes. If it wasn't for her, Debbie Beavers, and her high school, I don't know where we'd be right now. Our family owes them great gratitude, and I really can't wait till I get to meet her.
Yeah, she's done a lot of special things, certainly
yes,
helped me to be able to find you and now
yes.
put this fund together, which, as it turns out, has really been necessary.
Yes, she has gone beyond what she should do, and especially knowing her own circumstances, she put all that aside, and she is doing what she can to help the family between setting that up. She's more than my cousin's classmate. She is family just like you. We are grateful to both of you.
Well, we're very happy to be able to help. I think anybody who comes along in a situation like this and realizes there's a need, that there's something that maybe I'm capable of doing to help out, it's a joy to do that too, and I feel the same way, Kathy. God bless you and your family, and we'll be staying in touch. And look forward to hearing what your plans are and how things are progressing.
Oh, definitely will. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. And coming up next, Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com, answers another listener question about preservation. In 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Fisher here, the radio root sleuth with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. And Tom, you're going to keep it simple, stupid today, right? The KISS theory.
Exactly. At least stupid, hopefully simple, too.
Because you get us in a lot of trouble when you get too technical. And we got an email from Susanna Parsons in Stuart, Florida. She's asking about the copy of her old video that she made to her computer, and she's got an issue with matching up the audio and video. We kind of touched on this a couple of weeks ago. What does she do about this?
Okay, first off, let me kind of go back a little bit and keep somebody else from doing the same problem. What happens is computers are not designed to transfer an analog signal to a digital signal. They're made to read digital information.
Now, this is like the old TV stations, right? Why we needed to replace our old televisions?
Exactly. Yeah, you try and pick up an analog signal on a digital set, it's not going to work. So there's some computers that are really fast, that are good multimedia machines that can do this, but most people aren't going to go and spend an extra $1,000 just to get a real high-end AV computer, so to speak. And then you can go off to different places and buy these little components that are a translator from analog to digital. But most of them, as I've told people before, you get what you pay for. The equipment that we use and the other people out there that do transfers professionally, they have what we call hardware. It's a hardware device that turns your analog VHS tape into a digital signal to burn onto a DVD, and it does it in real time, so you don't have that lag. When you're doing it with a computer can process audio a lot quicker than it can a video signal because the video signal is so fat, so to speak.
Right, much larger.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So what happens is the lip sync gets off when you actually get to your final product, and you're going, hey, what happened here? Adobe makes some software, Premiere software you can go into. I believe Final Cut Pro does it as well. And you can go in and adjust. It's very, very time consuming because if it hasn't done it consistently slow, like say it's a tenth of a second all the way through, then you can just shift it. But generally, as your computer's trying to read the video, trying to read the audio, trying to sync it, it's fluctuating back and forth. So you might have to set up a whole bunch of different timestamps and adjust your audio, adjust your video, make them go together. And for most people, unless you have a lot of time on your hands, it's not worth it.
Wow. So that sounds really complex.
Oh, it is. It is. It's not that expensive. For instance, people send stuff to us all the time, and it usually costs about $17.95 or up, depending on where you go to transfer a VHS tape to a digital format. So I recommend instead of buying some expensive equipment, unless you have, tons of tapes, find out who the local person in your area is. See if they're hardware-based, and they can transfer your tape to a DVD, because then once it's on a digital format, like we talked about a few weeks ago, with Cinematize and other programs, you can go in and edit it. So that's the best way to do it. The best way to not have that problem is to do it right in the first place.
Okay. So now that she's got the problem, what does she do?
She's got to go into Premiere or Final Cuts Pro or one of those programs and actually adjust it. You're going to have to slide your audio and your video. You're going to have to set up little edits so you can stretch your audio or reduce the size of your audio. And sometimes you can actually change the speed just a little bit so the lip sync is back in, but it's not going to be like Mickey Mouse. So you can adjust it that way. But it's very time-consuming. It's hard. In fact, I would recommend to Susanna to take her videotape, go to a professional place, have them transfer it for you. Then you don't have these problems to worry about.
So start all over again.
I would. If it's a tape that you borrowed from somebody and you're not going to be able to get it out of their hands again, then go to Premiere, go to Final Cuts Pro, a program like that, and you can edit it within that.
He's our preservation authority. And, of course, when we talk preservation, that means we want to keep the stuff you've already got and make sure that future generations can enjoy it. And part of the problem we have right now in terms of dealing with transferring old home movies and old videos is the compatibility, right, Tom? The ability of actually playing something back on a different type of device. Things in the early days, back in the 80s and 90s, were always changing.
Oh, yeah, they were very incompatible, where nowadays companies are a lot smarter. They're making things backwards compatible. So if you buy something now, you'll be able to still play it 20 years from now, because now everything's electronics, it's little chips. In the old days, there were all kinds of circuits involved with it. There were patent problems, and everybody's trying to do their own things at their own way. But nowadays, it's pretty much this is the way it is. Either get on or get out.
Right. Now, I'm assuming back in the old days, people were trying to become the format that everybody uses. And so there was a lot of competition till it narrowed down to what we have right now.
Exactly. And probably the best example of this that a lot of our listeners will remember is the old Betamax and VHS wars. VHS was an inferior format, but yet the people that owned the rights to VHS licensed it to anybody that was willing to write them a check. And so VHS machines, since there were so many of them, the prices came down. But Sony owned Betamax and made all their people jump through all these hoops if they wanted to make their things. So there weren't as many Betamax players out there. There was less competition, so they cost more. People would go into the store and say, hey, well, this VHS machine is only X dollars, but the Betamax is X dollars more. And most people in the stores back then didn't know the difference between quality. It was a brand new media. But Betamax is so much better. We have people constantly bringing in Betamax tapes that are 20, 30, 40 years old, and they're wonderful. The quality of Betamax was so much better. However, they're totally incompatible with each other, and so Betamax went away. I got a call just the other day that says, do you have those adapters that I can put my Video 8 tape in and play it in my VCR?
Whoa, really? Are those out there?
No, there never have been, but people get confused. It's like whispering in somebody's ear, and after 10 people, the story changes. What happened is VHS came out with their machine at Betamax. Betamax died. VHS was there. Sony wanted to get back into the fray, so Sony comes out with Video 8. And Video 8 is the same two-hour cassette, but it's about a quarter the size. So the camcorders are a lot smaller. They're easier to hold. You don't have these
right.
Two great big huge things.
I think I have one of all of these things.
Exactly, and so do I. And so people go, ooh, I like this Video 8. It's small, compact. And so VHS is now going, oh my goodness, what do we do? So they came out with what they called VHS-C, which is just VHS compact. So they made an adapter that you put the VHS-C in, and it'll play in a normal VCR. We transfer these all the time. So people seeing those things think, oh, well, let me get one for Video 8. Now, you need to understand between VHS, Video 8, digital, that they're like different languages. They don't communicate with each other. They're a totally different format. The tapes are different sizes. It's just the wrong language.
So what's the solution?
Well, the solution is to come to either us or professional that can actually transfer your tapes to a digital format, whether it's a DVD or a hard drive, and then you can go in and edit it at your will. So that's the best thing to do is get everything on a digital format so you can have it on a disk, you can have it on a hard drive, and you can have it on a cloud. We always recommend those three and possibly even two clouds. Then you're protected.
It all seems to be the same answer. Get it down to the same format, right?
Exactly. And that's where things are great because the Green-Ray that are supposed to be coming out are compatible with Blu-ray, compatible with DVD, compatible with CDs. So now as the new stuff comes out, it's compatible. The disk you're using today might not be around, but the new one's coming out. We'll be able to play it.
All right. Great stuff, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Thanks once again to Randy Seaver, blogger extraordinaire with GenieAmusings.com, for his insight on crowdsourcing to find sources to trace your ancestors. It was great stuff. Also to Kathy Greaves Spurgeon for coming on and talking about her cousin, Teresa Rose Greaves, who we've spoken about the last couple of weeks. Talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family's story by going to FamilySearch.org.